Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast, where top football coaches from around the country share their stories, philosophies, concepts, and strategies to help you get better on and off the field. Now, here's your host, Keith Grabowski.
Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast and another episode in our Deep Dive on Defense series. Today is a really special one as we have a repeat performer on the podcast in the head football coach at Mississippi State, Joe Moorhead. I know this is a great one, a little bit of a crossover. I think this one has a ton of value for both the offensive guy and the defensive guy. Offensive guys and those guys on defense who want to hear about some of the things we're doing, please be sure to check out our weekly series, All In on Offense, where we take a deep, detailed dive on certain aspects of offense. So far, we've covered the installation plan with Noel Mazzoni. We've covered the four verts or six routes with air raid specialist, the guy who worked with June Jones, Hal Mummy, John Jenkins, and is now in the XFL, A.J. Smith. And then our episode this week was from Matt Drinkle, who's now at Army, and he talked about defeating the tight front. We have some great ones coming up on offense, and Coach Vass, as our guest host, is going to continue to do some great ones here on the defensive side of the ball in the Deep Dive on Defense series. So without further ado, I'll kick it over to Vass for today's podcast with Joe Moorhead, head football coach at Mississippi State.
Coach, thanks for coming on.
I really appreciate the opportunity. Look forward to talking some ball.
I love it. So defensive coaches, offensive coaches, whoever's listening, do not adjust your podcast app. We are doing the deep dive, and we are talking to a genuine, all-around great coach, but a stud on offense. I met Coach Moorhead, quote-unquote met. Somebody tagged me in a post a couple months ago, and it was a play, Mississippi State dominating someone, and asked me from a defensive perspective, what do you think went wrong? And so I kind of wrote this answer, and there was some banter back and forth. And then the next morning, I looked down at my app, my Twitter app, and I got a follow from Coach Moorhead. And I was, after I picked my jaw off the ground, I sent him a message saying, you know, thank you for the follow. I really appreciate what you do and what you do for the game. You know, you're one of the genuine guys in this business. And Coach wrote me a breakdown of the play that I had broke down, and we kind of had back and forth on how it all worked. And I was absolutely blown away. A genuine SEC head coach sitting and talking with little old me about how they read this certain play. And I was just, I was stunned, absolutely stunned. So I really appreciate you coming on. I'm really excited for the listeners and what they're going to be able to get out of this. But before we get into all the nuts and bolts of everything, tell me a little bit about your coaching journey and your background.
Yeah, I grew up in Pittsburgh, youngest of three. Dad worked in the mill, worked two or three jobs. You know, my mom stayed at home for the most part. We were all first-generation college, played football, basketball, baseball coming up. Was able to get an opportunity to go to Fordham University, Patriot League school in the Bronx. Played quarterback all 4 years there, started for three, played baseball my last year. Went overseas to Germany to play in the EAF, came back. You know, had a local free agent tryout for the Steelers and had a fall camp with an Arena League team and got cut there. And you get cut from the Arena League, you pretty much realize that your dream to be the next Dan Marino, who incidentally enough went to my high school, isn't going to happen. And, you know, decided that, you know, I wanted to still be involved in the game that had given me so much. And literally old school, had no clue how to break into the coaching profession. So I was still living with my parents at the time, went up to the local library, and I still remember to this day picking out a college atlas, for lack of a better term, and writing down the names and addresses of every 1A and 1AA school. I sent them all a resume and a form letter, got back a rejection letter from just about everyone, and did the same process again. I got back a bunch more rejection letters, and I guess as fate would have it, University of Pittsburgh, which actually my high school is essentially on their campus, had a opening for a recruiting graduate assistant, and Coach Harris brought me in, and went from recruiting graduate assistant year one to defensive graduate assistant year two, moved on from there to Georgetown in D.C. They were just moving to the Patriot League, from there to Akron, from Akron to UConn, from UConn to Fordham, from Fordham to Penn State, and then Penn State to here.
So when did you switch from the dark side to the light side? What stopped did you start coaching offense?
No, it's kind of funny you put it that way. I'd always been a quarterback. I played limited snaps of defense growing up. And, when I was a recruiting graduate assistant at Pitt with Coach Harris, you know, he was kind enough to let me kind of sit in on quarterback meetings and kind of pick his brain because he's a reputed, you know, West Coast guy and developer of quarterback mechanics and, you know, still do a lot of stuff to this day. But when the defensive graduate assistant position opened at Pitt, Larry Coyer, who's a longtime college coach and has coordinated in the NFL and, coached in Super Bowls, he wanted to bring me over. And you know, I thought it was an unbelievable opportunity. And to the young coaches out there, spending a year on the opposite side of the ball really shows you how much you know and how much you don't know. Because all the things that you think about defense from an offensive perspective, when you get a chance to go on that side of the ball and spend time, you learn how much you don't know. And for my entire 21-year coaching career, there wasn't a more valuable year than the year I spent on defense.
So that is, I mean, and I was going to ask you a little bit down the line, your experience on defense and how it informs your play calling and developing a game plan. But obviously in your formative years, doing that has been really helpful, as you said. And, that's one of my only regrets is I didn't spend time on the offensive side of the ball. I coached quarterbacks 1 year, but it was, you know, one of those high school things where you're coaching both sides, and I wasn't the coordinator. So he would tell me, this is what you need to do. This is exactly what we want. I'd go coach the quarterbacks, but I was a defensive coordinator. So I was more focused on that, as you'd expect. So talk to me about Mississippi State and how you have your offensive staff set up now. Or do you call plays? Do you have somebody else that does it? How involved are you with the game plan?
Yeah, I have a quarterback's coach who's our pass game coordinator, and he's been with me essentially since I was at UConn. And then when I left Fordham to go to Penn State, he was promoted to head coach. So he coaches the quarterbacks and handles pass game coordination, wide receivers coach, tight ends coach, O-line coach, who's a run game coordinator, and then our running backs coach. And essentially I'm the offensive coordinator. I sit on every offensive staff meeting. I run the room, you know, oversee the game plan, obviously give those guys a bunch of ownership and responsibility and allow them. I think that's one of the best things that we've done, not just here, but in other places I've been, is have a collaborative effort and have each person responsible for a particular area and make sure that their contributions are noted and utilized in the game plan. But yeah, I'm essentially the de facto offensive coordinator.
As the offensive coordinator, and you know, you said you run the room and you're running the meetings, when you get the tape on, I guess you wouldn't even call it tape anymore, but when you get the opponent's film exchange on Sunday, after you've graded your own film, when you're done with all that stuff and you've put the previous game to bed, when you go to study that defense, how many games are you studying?
We're going to use four, five absolute maximum. And then depending on the number of like formations, obviously early in the season, you have less games. Later in the season, you have more. Then we'll have the GAs and the QCs go through every game and then pull out just, you know, specific formations or situations that kind of fit what we need. And then by formation on first and second down, and then by our, you know, different situational areas, we have a number of plays that we want per cut up. So that's kind of how we organize the breakdowns.
Now, does that change by a certain opponent? Like if you're going into the Egg Bowl, will you say, you know what, we're going to watch every game. We're going to put every game in the breakdown, or do you keep it at that five max with those add-ins later?
It's a 4 to 5 max, with additional plays by formation. But as the offensive coordinator, I like Sunday night is one of the things I do that I'll go. And I will watch every game that they played throughout the course of the week. So, you know, Monday's the day that we come in and we really start the game plan. And, you know, Sunday you're reviewing the previous week's game. You're having an introduction practice after your meetings with the kids, and then you get back in the office. And then guys kind of, you know, we talk a little goal line, we talk a bit of short yards, we talk a little bit of protections and how we're going to set those for the week, but nothing's really set in stone. You know, and that's a time for me to kind of look at the games that we've put in, the breakdown, the 4 or 5, watch all of those sequentially, you know, on offense. And I'm going to go and pick probably two others and watch those on Sunday night. And then throughout the week, I'm going to make sure that by Friday, I will have watched each game beginning to end, you know, outside of when we watch it in the breakdowns.
When you're doing the film breakdown process, what are you first watching? Are you letting the tape run? Are you looking at cut-ups first? Like, you've just literally put the pass game to bed. You've closed that last folder, whatever, so to speak, and you go to fire it up. Are you trying to watch the cut-ups first? Are you watching their last game? What is your first part of the process?
As a coordinator and a head coach, I watch the games first, but as an entire staff, you know, we'll come in after staff meeting on Monday morning, and then we dive right into formations for first and second down in kind of the freewheel area.
When you start to go down the rabbit hole a little bit before you're watching generally speaking, but then when you start going, how much stock are you putting in down and distance when you're studying defenses?
Well, for us, first and second down, so we have P and 10, which is possession, you know, first play of each possession, first and 10 earned. And then we kind of have it broken down. Second and 1-3, second and 4-6, second and 7-10, and then second and 11 plus. So we really kind of watch all the formations and include all of those down and distances in it. And then to me, when it gets down to more of the play calling and game planning towards the end of the week, you're making more, specific, notations on, when you're going to call things that end up on the sheet. But for pure game planning purposes, we include P and 10, first and 10, and then all second downs in the formation cutups. And really the other thing is the utilization of reports. So at the end of the week is when I review the printed reports. And that's really, we're setting our first and second down game plan. And then Thursday and Friday towards the tail end of the week, I'm saying, all right, this is what we have in the game plan. And by this formation, this is what they play on P and 10. This is what they play on first and 10, and so on and so forth through the other down and distances.
Now, how much attention are you paying to field zone throughout the week? Now, I know for defense, a lot of us wait because it's kind of like if you can defend everything from a base structure, then you started picking at later as the week goes. I start adding those because what I found, just for me personally, and this is for some defensive coaches I've talked to, if we look at stuff like down and distance of field zone too early, we start having what I call a boutique game plan where it's like, oh, here's our second and long calls. By the way, we haven't fit up zone read out of every single call that we have yet. You know, we're trying to get too fancy. But from an offensive perspective where I think that matters more, are you always having that field zone thought in your press in your thought process as the week goes? Or are you kind of waiting to the middle of the week to start putting stuff in buckets?
I think that's a good point that you'd rather go from broad to narrow than the other way around. But with first and second down on Mondays, that's going to be the free. The way we break down our field zones is from the -1 yard line to the -15 is what we consider backed up. From the -16 to the +36 is what we consider free will, and that's mostly first and second down area on Monday. And then we break the red zone or red area down into four different categories. The fringe is the +35 to the +26. The red area or red zone is the +25 to the +16. The tight red zone is the +15 to the +6, and then the goal line is 5-1. So once we knock the free roll out on Monday, then each day sequentially, as you mentioned, is when we start hitting the different areas. So we'll hit third down red zone on Wednesday, third down on Thursday, and then kind of, fill in the rest of the blanks, two-minute, four-minute, backed up, all the end-of-game situations. And as you mentioned, start from a broad perspective and then kind of narrow down to get very specific as the week ends.
When you're coming up with a game plan and you're picking your plays and what you did at your last formations, how much is your self-scout going into that decision-making? Are you consciously saying, hey, last week we ran this play out of this formation, let's do something opposite? Like, is that always kind of in the back of your mind? Is it something that is always informing your game planning as you go? Or is there a certain point in the week when you stop and say, hey guys, okay, are we breaking tendencies? Like, do you have like a point where you look at that, or is it kind of just always in your thinking?
It's twofold, and it's going to be at the beginning of the week, and then it's going to be with the reports on Friday when I review those on my own, after we meet on Friday. So essentially on each cut up, what we'll do, so let's just say we're watching an 11 personnel 2x2 formation that we run. the very first slide of that cut up. And he talked about giving the assistant coaches ownership and investment and allowing them to be part of the process. So the first slide before we start looking at the opposition is what we've done. Duo formation, this is the number of runs, this is the number of passes. Back set strong, back set weak, same thing. And then the next slide is how people have defended us. And then once we kind of have that information and the coaches jot their notes down, then we get into watching the film of the breakdown for that week. So at the tail end of the week on Fridays, once again, it's not as much visual as it is printed. And I'm going to go through kind of battery of printed reports for our self scout, run pass overall, run pass by down a distance, run pass by formation, and a combination of each, and then going through all the different situations as well.
It's always been fascinating to me, and economic decision making, quote unquote, and what, how much time do we have? What are we going to do? And I've always said, I don't know if I could coach offense because I would drive myself crazy. First of all, I'd give the defensive coordinators way too much credit. And second of all, I would do – do you remember The Water Boy? You see The Water Boy, the movie with Adam Sandler?
Oh, yeah. Many times.
When he says, we're going to fake it. No, we're going to think about faking it. That would be me. Oh, I would
absolutely
psych myself out to the point – because for you, it's, okay – what do we do? Okay, what did the teams that have played this team, what have they done? What do we want to do that we see that nobody's done yet? And like making those decisions on what you're going to focus on in that pressure cooker environment and as the head coach, and especially I'm sure in the SEC, I mean, you have your own network. There's probably a lot of different demands on you. I mean, heck, that play that I broke down on Twitter, that how we kind of connected, you were on the SEC network and you're sitting there with somebody from ESPN. Yep. And going through it. I mean, that to me has always been fascinating from a defensive coach is looking to the other side and seeing how much of it are you picking up from what other people have done, what you want to do. And that balance has always been kind of fascinating to me personally. But now when you're early in the season and you have an opponent, they have different personnel from the previous year and or a new scheme, how do you change your approach when you're limited on data from the opponent?
Yeah, I think with the personnel change, that's all a little bit relative. Based on who the coordinator is, whether he's new or he's returning, and kind of what you expect. So essentially, you're going to get their post-spring depth chart and kind of look at who the returnees are and who they're losing and see if you have information on those guys. And if there's, film to back it up, you'll kind of make a personnel evaluation. If not, then you got to kind of make a little bit of a guesstimate. But if you don't have fit, if there's film on the team that you're playing and it's from the prior season and it's the same coordinator, that's always the easy one. When it's a new coordinator, obviously you're trying to find film from one of his previous stops. And if it's neither of those, then if you don't have, if it's not a returning coordinator and you can't get film on the place the guy had been, or you're unsure what their scheme is going to be, then it really becomes a bit of a vanilla approach, and kind of focus more on what you're doing than what they're doing.
Now, what do you think is the? And I don't even know if this is a question that's has a definitive answer or a simple answer, but what do you think, to you, just right off the top of your head, what do you think is the single most important thing to identify from an opponent when you're watching? Like, what's the thing that you're popping out, like the most important piece of information you need or want?
Who? Overall in the film breakdown?
Yeah, just either in the film breakdown or when you're just watching a team in general, or you're putting something together, like, what are you looking for? What's the number one thing that kind of stands out?
The I don't know if it's the overall thing, but the first thing I'm look at is personnel, overall, and that at the specific levels, front, backers, and then back end.
Now, and again, these are hypotheticals, and you got to remember, bear in mind, please excuse me, I am a defensive coach. I don't know if these questions even apply to an offensive standard. It might be like a question that everybody knows the answer to, and you're all yelling at me on your app like, dude, everybody knows this, so apologies. At what point that, and it's kind of that we talked about that balance of that economic decision making on what to do, at what point do you simply say, we're going to do what we do best, we're going to run our offense, we're going to say, hey, let's stop us? How do you navigate that balance between damn it, we're the Mississippi State Bulldogs, and we're going to go kick some butt, and we're going to run what we're going to run, and we're going to do what we're going to do, and they're going to adjust to us. And how do you balance that with that mentality with also, hey, guys, like to roll to cover three on third and four? You know what I mean? Like, what? How do you keep that balance?
I think as a coach at any level, you know, NFL, college, high school, or, you know, we all still remain in the sport because we're type A's and we have a tremendous amount of confidence in our ability, you know, to dial up plays and to call them and prepare the team and get them motivated and prepared. But one thing that's always stuck with me, a coach told me a long time ago, it's not what we know, it's what the players can execute. So I think it's always a combination of, you know, what is the matchup, and not always trying to necessarily, you know, stick a square peg in a round hole. It's a fine line of, hey, we're going to run our system, we're going to do what we do, but at the same time have enough flexibility, you know, within it to make some, you know, changes, make some adjustments, you know, based on, you know, what you're able to do with your kids versus what the defense of particular week is presenting. So, I mean, I would love to run play X, Y, or Z, and I think I'm good at teaching it, and I think, you know, we could get it dialed up in the right situation. But ultimately, at the end of the day, if our kids can't do it and they can't do it against the defense that's coming out that we're going to see that week, or vice versa, then it's something we eliminate from the game plan. I think that goes back to kind of a broader discussion that, with what we do systematically, you know, we're not a play of the week or scheme of the week. And, you know, we're not going to be pro style I 1 week and then try to be run and shoot spread the next week and do the triple option the week after. You know, we believe in doing what we do, but we also believe that there's enough flexibility in it with the number of runs that we have with the RPOs and being a RPO based run game combined with the West Coast pass team. You know, we're able to fill in a lot of those gaps that may occur when there's a disparity in talent in a certain position.
That's fascinating to hear how it all comes together. Now, you mentioned about looking for personnel, and we talked about scheme. You know, you hear at the NFL level that it's all matchups. It's all matchups. Everybody runs the same plays, yeah, quote unquote, and it's about finding that matchup. How much do you think college is more of your game plan, the personnel, or more of the scheme? Or I know it's a blend of both, but if you were on a seesaw, what side is weighing more on your brain as you're going through?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. And then, you know, haven't had the opportunity to coach in the NFL, but kind of hear some of those same things, you know, about it being, you know, matchups at that level. And I think you probably see a more diverse set of schemes at the college level, you know, and because both sides, I mean, in the ongoing chess match, you know, you're going to see on a given week in 12 game season, you'll see a spread team. We'll probably see a couple spread teams. You may see a pro eye kind of pounded at your team, and heck, you may see a triple option team. And I think in line with that, how often offenses have become spread out and forcing defenses to defend not just the length of the field but the width of the field, and it's not a phone booth game anymore. It's an open field game. I think that's forced defensive coordinators to become more creative, become more aggressive, and become more specialized in their approach. So I want to say there it is. Matchups are important, but I think the breadth and the width of things that defensive coordinators are doing at the college level and offensive coordinators are doing, that it's as much about scheme to me. It's as much about scheme as it is about personnel.
Okay, that's kind of the thought that I had. But again, I'm not a Division I offensive coordinator. I know that there are, I mean, you with the advent of the three safety stuff that Iowa State does. I know they're not in your conference, but you know, I study a lot of the SEC defenses. And I know you have with the Coach Saban tree, there's a lot of similarities rather in between what Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee does, but there are some major differences. But some of the different things you see with Coach Aranda does, what Coach Shoup at your place does, it's very exciting. I mean, and I don't mean to dump on the NFL, but I can't watch NFL defense, maybe minus, you know, Coach Belichick or something. It's just, it's so, I mean, I don't, we don't see that stuff, and the answers that they're provided just doesn't, it doesn't fit with what we do. And I know for offense it's a little different, but especially I know when I was at Sarah, we were fortunate enough to have an NFL, a former NFL or a current NFL coach who was coached at the high school, and they came and, you know, talked about some of the man beater concepts they had, and that really actually helped us. But I just think the game is so much similar from high school to college than college to the pros. It just feels like the pro game is completely different. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, like I said, I'm a Steelers guy, so if I catch a game on Sunday or maybe something on Thursday or a playoff game, you know, I'll kind of watch it. But, you know, just from a knee-jerk kind of assumption reaction, it does appear that there's probably more schematic alignment or diversity in some of the, and I think, once again, I think it goes back to the advent of the spread RPO offense and forcing people to really kind of, you know, be on their toes of how to operate it and how to defend it. And I think there is a trickle-up effect. I do believe that for whatever reason, a lot of the things that we've been doing for years in this system and people are doing across the country, you're starting to see more and more of it in the NFL. At least that's my perception. I don't know if it's reality.
Yeah, I mean, and I know this is going to sound dumb, but Madden football, that's all they're marketing this year. The RPOs are now in Madden football. I mean, that's RPOs. I remember the first time I heard about RPOs, I went to the Tony Franklin seminar in 2012, March, April of 2012. And I was in a job interview. I just happened to be, it was actually in Mississippi. And my buddy said, hey, come with us. And Tony Franklin, I was at the Tony Franklin seminar, and he was talking about running the ball and throwing it, read off the second level defenders. And I remember between the break, I called my best friend, Stephen Lowe, and I was like, oh my God, you'll never believe this. My mind was blown. But honestly, I saw stuff coaching Division III football that took a couple years to trickle up. And I mean, we saw a team, Rhodes College, that gave us fits running certain things that I didn't see go to the college level for another 3 years. And they were really hurting us with us.
I say that all the time. And I've had the fortune of being a player at the FCS level and then having time at Georgetown and at Fordham. And I really truly believe a lot of times that the coaches at, you know, the 1AA FCS, whatever you want to call it, Division II, Division III, I mean, that some of the most creative and innovative minds and things that you see at that level, I like to call it the bus league. You know, those are things where guys really like to take chances.
Yep.
They like to take chances. They like to be creative. And some of the best stuff I've seen has been stuff at those levels.
And I'll shout them out. Birmingham Southern College, when we played them, and I coached at Millsaps down the road from you, and we saw Birmingham Southern Center College. I mean, and some of it was necessity, and some of it, I think, to be honest with you, was lack of fear of being embarrassed or fired.
Yeah, they were startup two program, weren't they, or D3, something along those lines. They were a new program.
Birmingham, I know, honestly, I don't know the history, but I know the Birmingham Southern Mississippi College that went from D3, I believe, to D2. Please, nobody get upset with me if anybody listens at MC. Some of the best, it was Wing T. It was Wing T out of a sniffer, 20 personnel sniffer.
And, oh, really?
Or 21 personnel. They'd flex the tight end out, and it was basically like shotgun Wing T, and it was because guys aren't afraid. They're not coaching scared. Because, you know, there's some of it is, there's a lot of CYA. I'm sure you've seen it. At your level across the years, and this, you know, if you do something crazy and it doesn't work and you're on ESPN, then everybody's hopping online anonymously talking smack about you, and you gotta worry about that. Yeah. At our level, nobody cared. I mean, no offense, but I'm not talking about myself. So, you know, if we made a bold choice and went for it, and when we weren't supposed to, there were no message boards, so to speak.
Yeah, that was the fun part of being at Fordham too, that you know, we kind of put the new system in place, and obviously you're in the media market of the world, but you know, there were some other games in town. The Jets and Giants.
Just a few.
Good time. But yeah, absolutely.
So, Coach, we've talked about some of the process during your week and how you split things up amongst the staff and how you plan it out for yourself in the meetings. How do you put that all together to streamline your game plan, and how does that affect how you practice in your script and turning that into the final product and the call sheet for game day?
Yeah, just taking it through the week by day. You know, on Sunday we'll come out, and the first part of our practice will be corrections from the previous day, and that'll be a 10-minute period. And you know, we'll mirror it so we get it on both hashes, and then we'll do a little bit of special teams, and then we'll break into a 10-minute introduction for the run game and a 10-minute introduction for the pass game for the upcoming week. And that'll be first and second down. We talked about Monday being our game plan day, and then Tuesday we'll come out. And the entire day's focus will be first and second down. On the following day, on Wednesday for practice, we'll get a little bit more first and second down. And then the concentration will be, red zone and then third down. And then Thursday, we kind of put it all together. We'll get first and second down. We'll get backed up. We'll get third and short, third medium, third long. And then we'll get fringe, red zone, tight red zone, and goal line. And then at one point during the week, and it kind of mixes up by day, we'll get a 2-minute drill in there.
So that stays pretty standard from week to week. There's not much variation, I'm assuming, in that.
No. I mean, sometimes we like to get a little good on good work just for speed. You know, when you're going against scouts, kind of it's tough to replicate what you're going to see on a weekly basis in SEC play. So we may do a fastball 7-on-7 or a fastball team. You know, but that's kind of intermittent because we feel like the replication of the look, you know, is more important than the speed of it for the most part.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess my mentor used to say, it's not the route that's beating you, it's who's running that route. So we started incorporating that more this past year, trying to do some good on good. In high school, it's a little harder because the offenses can be so different. We played the single wing, the wing T-ish, a 22 personnel I team, and then a team that's an empty. And so sometimes, some of those weeks, you're like, hey, I don't really need to good on good this week, thank you. You still want to stay fresh, but you're trying to fit up how to defend the single wing. The last thing you're thinking about is how to stop 4-strong load pass, but I digress.
I would imagine the 2-platoon part of it, you know, for some teams who don't have the depth at the high school level, makes it a little more difficult of needing an offensive day and a defensive day when kids, you know, have to go both ways. I would bet that throws an extra kind of wrench into the works.
Yeah, I've been lucky enough. I consider it lucky enough my entire career, except my first gig, where we were platooned, and so we had an offense and a defense. And I get that question a lot, you know, what would you do if you weren't? And I honestly don't know. I've never done it before with any regularity, and I definitely wouldn't want to tell people what I did my first year in coaching as some sort of advice.
Yeah, probably an interesting topic. Good thing to kind of hear.
Yeah, no, that's actually throwing out an idea there. I think we might need to talk about that in the future. So I want to kind of talk about attacking defenses specifically, and these are some questions that for the listeners that submitted the questions, I apologize. I was in a hurry to get these written down. So credit to those who asked the questions. I didn't get all the Twitter handles and whatnot, but one of the questions that I got, and some of these are you can't answer in terms of just, it just depends sometimes. Maybe there's not a yes or no or a one or the other.
Yeah.
But one of the listeners asked, do you fear one front that is excellent that, you know, a team that they do this one thing and they do it really well, you know where they're going to be, but they got dudes? Or are you more concerned with teams that run a lot of different fronts? They're still very effective, but maybe not as dominant as that one front.
Now, I'd say the one singular front that seems to be kind of the trend these days, particularly in our conference, is we call it the Okie 4-eye front, you know, where it's three down and, you know, zero nose, and then, you know, 2 4-eyes, and sometimes it's a 5 and a 4-eye, or a lot of movement within that. But the ability, not just with that, to do it out of 4-down personnel and stem in and out of 3 and 4-down looks out of the same people, I'd say that's the thing. I would say that causes the most problems, but it, just in terms of communication. And then the run game, it being numbers, angles, and grass, you know, the things out of that front that can cause you some problems, particularly in the backside of the zone game.
Interesting. Do you, as a offensive coordinator, do you prefer to see more odd or even defenses? Or, you know, is that something that you don't really care about?
No, it does. I think they each pose their, you know, pose a different set of issues, you know, either personnel-wise or scheme-wise. And I forget what coach was, I heard one time that he used to say, an offensive-minded coach said, you know, four down equals touchdown. So he always wanted to see a four-down defense as opposed to three down. But I guess it depends on who the four down are and who the three down are. But I think with the flexibility of our run game and the different things that we're able to do, you know, mixing in zone and gap schemes, that if a team's going to play a certain front, it's just going to really kind of, I don't want to say dictate what we do, but what we're going to major in for that particular week.
Right, and you have enough flexibility where you don't have to bang your head against the wall if there's something that you're like, you know what, this isn't something great for what we have, but it opens this up. And I think that's the trick in high school. I think some guys, with the time and things, the run game, especially in today's spread passing game, the run game may not be diverse. Some may not feel that they have enough in their package. And I've talked to guys that, you know, they're always like, you know, we need to have more diversity because of all the different defenses you see in high school. I mean, it's, you'll see, I was in a league where we had 3-4, we had 4-2-5, we had 5-3, double eagle cover one. I mean, you were seeing everything, new and old. Now, when you're seeing an even front, are there certain runs you like to attack the one technique and the certain runs you like to attack the three technique?
I think in terms of the zone game, it depends to me on whether you're cutting off the backside end or you're reading them. You know, some people, if it's a 6-for-6 run and you're trying to run either split zone or inside zone with the tight end on the backside cutoff, they'd rather run that to the low technique, you know, to the shade so you get two double teams. And, you know, people running the zone read want to run it 2-to-3 and have the bubble backside just so the tackle has better access up to the backside backer. Now, that creates another set of problems where how is the team, and it's something that we study on a weekly basis, how are they defending the zone read? You know, are they a friction team? Are they a hold team? Are they a squeeze scrape? Are they a bend scrape? You know, so, you know, if a team's, you know, really good at the bend scrape and they're going to do that to a shade five side, you know, you've got to have some kind of other mechanism where it's just not a pull because the quarterback will never get to the third phase. We have some other things that we do with that. But tackle wrap, you like to run that to the low technique, you know, so that the tackle has a good entry point coming through. You know, some of the other stuff, pin and pull, you know, more of the gap schemes, I think it really doesn't matter. One back power sucker, you know, those are things you can run to just about anything. ISO, you know, draw, you like that to the low technique too.
Anything you like particularly to a three?
To the three, I prefer power to the three, either the read or the one back. But it's really not the end of the world if you run it to the low technique. But I like the deuce off the ball, and you know, to me, it protects the backside A gap run through. You know, when you run it to the three technique and have the shade backside.
That makes sense. Now, going into the pass protection world, how are you game planning your pass protection? So that first day you're coming in, you're starting to watch the team. What's your starting point? What are you looking for? What are some of the things that when you're putting together? And I know all these questions come with the caveat that at some point you're going to do what you do and do what you do best, and you know, you got to just say this is who we are. But if the game planning element and you're deciding one thing versus another, what are you looking for when you're starting to game plan that pass pro?
Well, I think it's two separate things. I think the first thing is you're looking at first and second down pass protections, whether it be five-man, six-man, or some of the seven-man max pro stuff. And then you get into the third medium plus. To me, that's a little bit of a different world. But, you know, really by formation or by down and distance, you want to see, are they bringing single pressures to the field or multi-backer or secondary pressures to the field? And then what are they doing to the boundary? And, you know, what are they doing that breaks the protection down? What are the tendencies in terms of pressures to the shade or pressures 2-to-3? You know, what is the secondary tilt? What is the linebacker skew? So all those things. So more necessarily, what do we need to do to get the protection slid the right way or change to pick up the pressure and creating a new protection to pick up a particular blitz?
I had another buddy ask me, how did you game plan? And I know, you know, it's practice is practice. And, you know, you got to do what you got to do. And it's a fine line of, hey, you know, we got to work on what we're working on, especially in spring when you have good on good. But somebody wanted me to ask you, how do you deal with a guy like Montez Sweat in practice? Do you have a special protection? Just say, hey, guys, we got to work what we're working on? Like, when you have a human being that's that big and can run that fast, what do you do? besides Bray?
Well, here was the issue. You had Montez on, at 1-5 technique. You had Gary Green, who was a fifth-round pick of the Colts, on the other end. And then Jeffrey Simmons on the inside, who you know, arguably was the top inside guy. So wherever you were sliding it, there was, you know, you couldn't pick one to double team. You know, you don't necessarily want to chip those guys in practice because that's not what's best for your squad. But I think more than anything, we did a pretty good job in pass protection this year outside of, you know, the Kentucky game where the Allen kid got after us a little bit. But I think, you know, the old saying, and it's a little cliche, iron sharpens iron. You kind of do what you do and, you know, make your guys work at it. And, you know, it's like getting a, you know, reps at the Senior Bowl, you know, every day in practice when you're going against those guys. Because you really, what you don't want to do is change what you're doing for the sake of, you know, gaining an upper hand on one side of the ball. You know what I mean? And that goes offense, defense, or defense, offense.
Yeah, that's something I think, especially defensive coordinators struggle in, because I think offense, you can largely dictate a lot of things. And, you know, this some of it's reactionary, but it's you dictate a lot more, obviously, than defense, where, you know, when I was at Sarah San Mateo, we were a no-huddle spread Baylor-esque team, and yeah, our top five opponents were wing T, option, double wing, and then an amalgamation of things. And I, like a 12 personnel, Boise, old style Boise offense. And then we get into practice and they're trying to snap the ball at 18 seconds and you got these wide splits. And so that was something we always kind of, and I know a lot of my friends who see unique offenses in practice and then they go see something completely different week to week. How do you, you know, what's the balance, especially when you're on a new staff and you want to make a good impression with your kids? You know, most of the place I've been hired, the head coach is already established, and so I come in and I want to make a good impression. So some of that's like, you know, you can only tell a 16-year-old kid, hey, don't worry, we're getting our butt kicked here, but, you know, when we get in the season, it'll be different. So Milan, before they just look at you and go, are you completely full of crap or just a little bit full of crap?
That's the one thing that we're, like, in spring ball, we're going to just go good on good the entire time. But once fall camp hits, yeah, every day in practice, we schedule two what we call install review or separate periods. So in between, you know, either 7-on-7s or team periods, there's two 7-minute blocks where the defense takes their guys, the offense takes our guys, and we may work on, you know, first and second down, 3-down fronts, which our defense really doesn't do, and they may work a 12 personnel or a 21P period, which we really don't run. So there's right, 15 minutes a day throughout the course of those 29 opportunities in fall camp. You're giving each side of the ball to work on something that the other side doesn't present. We thought that's always been beneficial for us.
So now talking about coverages, what are you looking for in setting your progressions for certain coverages? Is there certain ways you like to read things versus certain coverages, or what coverages do you like to see? What are some things that you're looking for when you're seeing those different coverages and telling your quarterbacks, hey, look for this, look for that, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, our quarterback pre-snap checklist or progression is one high, two high, man eyes, zone eyes, and then we scan the front, you know, see if it's 3 or 4 down and where the techniques are, and then we scan the backers. And then we're really keyed into the safeties and the backers with their leverage in terms of pressures. But, you know, when we're breaking down the film, when we're creating a game plan, I want to know man or zone. That's the first thing I want to know. I want to know one high or two high. Then I want to know the coverage family, meaning is it zone, is it fire zone, is it eat man, or is it zero? And then the last thing we look at is access or no access, meaning to the field, you know, is it cloud or off coverage? And then we kind of put that whole picture together, you know, by however many clips are in the cut-up. So how many are one high, how many are two high, how many are four down zone, how many are four down man, how many are five man pressure with man behind it, how many are five man pressure with zone behind it, and then what is the off and cloud to the field and boundary. So that all those things put together kind of create a picture of, you know, what they're doing. And then, you know, with our pass game, you know, we have a bunch of different mechanisms within that to attack those types of coverages.
That's great. That's sometimes it's – and the whole point of what we're doing here today is, you know, we always, as coaches, we'll talk about – you know, we'll talk, a lot of us, we stay on our side of the ball and we talk to defensive coaches about what we think offensive guys are looking at. And it's really interesting to hear, instead of us guessing, like, well, what do you think they're doing? And again, actually talk to somebody, especially of your caliber and at your level, to tell us, well, this is actually what we do.
Yeah, and that's what, when we went back to the to one of the first things we talked about, you know, spending that year on the defense side of the ball earlier in my career and kind of get behind the enemy line, so to speak. I couldn't think of a more beneficial season than that one. I mean, it was really awesome.
Yeah, because then when you're doing that, you could say, okay, well, what did we do? What were we looking at? And I just, like I said to you earlier, I wish I would have had that experience more in depth. Now, talking about attacking personnel, how do you compensate for defensive personnel at each level of the defense? When you're looking to attack a D lineman or a back or a safety or corner, what are some of the different things you like to do, especially if you got somebody who's really good, like we talked about, going from that from the front end to the back end? What are some of the answers that you or things that you look for when you're trying to do that?
Well, there's one general thought process we have in our game plan, and because of our ability to read people at the first, second, and third level, is that if you can't block them, read them. So as we scan across the front, and if there's a what we call a game wrecker, you know, a three technique, a shade, a five technique, maybe a backer or a safety that's really screwed down in at a run support, you know, we're going to find a way if we can't single block them. And if a double team doesn't work, then we're going to put a formation together and a scheme together, you know, that he becomes the read and, you know, allow him to use either his aggressiveness or physicality against him.
Well, that's the old option adage. If you can't block them, read them rather. And if you can't read them, block them. I guess there's that too.
no question.
So, steering more towards defensive coaches in this question, specifically high school guys, what is one thing that you see lacking coming from with your incoming freshmen, and specifically the defensive players, that you wish that high school defensive coaches would improve upon or coach more? That there's something that we can tangibly do to help you guys at the next level, so you're not having to start from scratch, so to speak.
I don't think necessarily there's much anything, and you know, obviously with the number of hours you guys get per week than we get per week, and that differs for the NFL. I think the biggest thing that's the adjustment for incoming players at our level, you know, isn't necessarily fundamentals and technique or scheme, because there's only, you know, so many ways to play cover two, so many ways to play a third or a quarter, you know, and all those other things. The adjustment is the speed of the game and the physicality of it. And I think, high school coaches, you know, across the country are doing an unbelievable job coaching them up and getting them ready. You know, it's our job to kind of fine tune it and build upon it. And more than anything, they get those wide eyes early on. And maybe, you know, I think the buildup of the installations in a quick pace, I think that's something that the kids need to get used to, early on. That, you know, it's not just, you know, one thing and you install it and you work on that for you know, a whole week. Something new is going in, you know, every day for the first, 7 to 10 days, and you got to have great recall.
That's the speed of the game. That's the one you always hear about. This was an interesting question. It's kind of general, but I thought it was a pretty interesting question from a listener. How do you plan for the unexpected? How do you try to minimize those situations where you might get a surprise? What are some things that you do with your team or you personally to try to, you know, run scenarios or have different, whatever it may be, in a game or with your team?
From an offensive construct, I think the big thing with that is that with our scheme, and, you know, like to refer to as somewhat sophisticated simplicity, that we're not reinventing the wheel every week. So because of, we call them banked reps, the touchdown pass that Saquon scored in the Big Ten championship game on the wheel route, I mean, that wasn't even on the call sheet, but we had run that play, you know, an over-under concept with a wheel on the backside so many times during the season and so many times back that I just called it off the cuff and the kids executed. They didn't even, you know, bat an eye. You call the play and they run it. So I think having the confidence as a play caller and a coordinator that you've run certain plays enough times and the kids are accustomed to reacting to what a defense may present to them, I think it becomes more incumbent upon the coach to be able to react in those pressure situations and call the right play. And have enough times during the season where you've repped it, that you're kind of not closing your eyes and dipping your hand into a bag and, you know, I guess grab bagging for lack of a better term, that you run the play enough times you can really call it at any point during the game.
I like that, banked reps. Now I got to ask you a question. Are you a Seinfeld fan, or did you ever watch Seinfeld?
Absolutely. No, 100%. I would guess okay. If I haven't seen every episode, I've seen probably 95% of them.
Okay, well, I'm going to give you a hard time here. I appreciate you coming on, but I got to give you a little bit of a hard time here. During the intro,
okay,
you yada, 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 the equivalent of yada, yada, yada over having Saquon Barkley as a player. You're like, yeah, and I was at Penn State, and just like went right over, and I'm like, everybody's going to be listening to me like, dude, tell us about what it's like to coach Saquon. I know this is supposed to be a defensive podcast, but you got to tell me a little bit about that. Now that you mentioned,
so I yada the bisque is what you're saying.
Yeah,
yada the bisque. I remember that one. That's when George was dating the lady. I got you. Yep, that's one of the all time best episodes. But and it sounds so cliche because you see Saquon and he seems, you know, like such a genuine, sweet, caring, nice kid, and humble and down to earth. And it couldn't be more truthful than what it appears, you know, as you see him, you know, with what we did at Penn State and with what we did at what he's doing in the NFL now, that, you know, his ability is only superseded by his character. He's just a selfless, great teammate, you know, cared more about the team than he did, whether he had 100 yards or 200 yards or 50 yards, you know, as long as we won. And, you know, you want people to get what they deserve. You know, he absolutely is getting everything that he deserves.
That must be such an incredible feeling. I've had certain players that were just, you know, you watch them sometimes at practice and you're in awe, but I can't imagine coaching a guy like that. That must have just been amazing.
No, I'll tell you this. When you you look at the call sheet and you don't know what to dial up, you know, handing it to 26 or getting it to him on the perimeter was always a pretty good idea. So that was always a good safety net when you're walking that play calling tightrope.
Well, I was excited to interview you for many reasons, but I was studying a defense, I believe it was last offseason, and I don't remember who it was, but they were playing you, and I got caught like 10, 15 clips. I didn't even realize, it didn't even dawn on me. I was just having fun watching your offense, and I found myself not even watching the defense. And because for me, like, my eyes always go to the defensive side of the ball, and I mean, I think that's just a testament to what you do and how you structure everything, and your offense is exciting to watch and fun. And I'm really happy that we got to talk, and I'm looking forward to your future successes for you. And so now I'm going to go into the last part of the podcast.
Okay.
Now, usually at the end of this podcast, I ask my guests the questions, and it's usually from a defensive perspective. But since you're on and you're our first offensive guest, I'm going to ask you the same question, and here's the scenario. It's 4th and 9, 35-yard line going in. There's 12 seconds left on the clock, and you got a timeout, so you don't have to get the ball out of bounds. But you're really just trying to get that first down. You have a field goal kicker that's nails. You trust him with everything. You're wanting to get that first. You just got to push it past that 9 yards, get him in position. And he doesn't even have a preferred hash. The whole playbook's open. So in that situation, what's your gut reaction? What are you going to call?
First thing, we're going to go out and I'm going to get the formation lined up as quickly as possible and try to use a freeze cadence to try to get the defense to dictate or show its hand or see if they're going to switch out of it when we look over. And, you know, really would like to try to get into a 2x2 just to allow the defense to kind of present itself. Would hope to get into a two-man man beater to the field and a two-man multi-purpose zone beater to the boundary and allow the quarterback to read it post-snap and see what side of the field to work. So get our best two-man man beater to the field, best two-man zone beater to the boundary, and then off of that have a seven-man max pro zero beater or some kind of wide receiver screen package with it. So I'm going to go with a multi-purpose 2x2 man zone beater with a zero beater ready in case they're planning to bring the house, which, you know, looking back on it in retrospect, that's kind of what Florida did. And we didn't have the zero beater ready and Coach Grantham dialed up a great one and got home on it.
Man, that is so fascinating. I ask, and I love this question because it kind of gives you the personality, especially on defense, because you don't have that ability to kind of control. You got to make a call. And we've had two-man, we've had bring four from a side. We had a coach say he's going to bring seven guys and just say, screw it. So I love this question, and it's really fascinating to see the other side, how much thought goes into that one scenario. And I, and for the listeners, Coach did not get any of these questions in advance. I was like, we're going to talk about football. He's like, cool, thanks. You know, so the fact that that's rolling off the top of his head with that much thought and detail into it, that's really impressive. So, Coach, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. It has been awesome to look at how a great offensive mind like yourself, how you view us, how you look at us, and how you plan to attack us. I can't thank you enough for your time, and best wishes this upcoming football season.
No, I appreciate it. You're really doing an awesome job, and anything we can, anything that we can do as college coaches or pro coaches or high school coaches to lift the game up and improve what we do to ultimately do what's most important, that's to help our kids improve fundamentally, technique-wise, and become the best teams we can be. I think we should, as coaches, that's our responsibility and our duty to make sure we're doing everything we can to help improve each other.
Absolutely, Coach. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you, Chris.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please be sure to check out all we're doing on our Twitter handle for coaches at FBDEVCoach. We have all kinds of great content there posted daily. Check out our show notes at blogs.usafootball.com. You'll get the links to other podcasts like Coach Moorhead's first podcast with us, as well as some relevant articles and other podcasts. And check out our systems for blocking and defeating blocks at footballdevelopment.com, as well as our advanced tackling system. Please note that Coach Vass will be on our video series. Coming up here in a couple weeks, we have the Fight to Finish philosophy of the Five Fights tackling system. And check out our blogs for that whole series as well. You're going to get about 10 hours of video where we go through and analyze the tackle with different coaches around the country, as well as get prescriptive for things they can do to help your team. I promise your defense will get something out of this, and you will become better by going through this series. Check it out at blogs.usafootball.com. And if you are enjoying the podcast, please head over to iTunes and give a 5-star rate or take a minute to write a review. We appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast. For more resources, visit the Coach Performance Center at usafootball.com.